Welcome to the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Philip Moore for Radio Reading Services. This week I'm reading from the July 22nd, 2019 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. The cover story this week, One Giant Feat for Mankind, How the Moon Landing 50 Years Ago Inspired a Nation and Changed the World, by Eva Botkin-Kowacki. Before we delve into the cover story, here is an introductory article which will provide some background and context for the main article by weekly editor Owen Thomas. His column is headlined, The Moon Moment. The greatest generation has Pearl Harbor and VE Day. Baby boomers have the Beatles' first appearance on Ed Sullivan and Neil Armstrong stepping onto the moon. Ask anyone who was alive and sentient in July 1969, and they'll tell you where they were when they saw it, and pretty much everyone did. I, a young outer space nerd, was aware for the first time that history was happening right in front of me. I struggled to find words for the moment, but all I managed in my journal was to note the room in our house where I watched it, and a careful description of what I was wearing. So much for the big thoughts, but at least I knew for certain that I embraced that epic event in a navy blue polo shirt and wheat-colored jeans. In this week's cover story, Monitor reporter Eva Botkin-Kowacki, to whose generation the moon program seems mythic, adds context, insight, and detail to the momentous mission in those politically fraught times. Many have noted that without the impetus of the Cold War, America would never have gone to the moon. But did you know that it was Apollo 17 geologist astronaut Harrison Jack Schmidt's unique way of getting around on the lunar surface that may have led to his making a big discovery? Eva heard the story from Dr. Schmidt himself, the 12th human to walk on the moon, if you're counting. Fellow outer space geeks will also be delighted to hear from Charles Duke Jr., the CAPCOM, Capsule Communicator, in Houston's Mission Control for Apollo 11 flight. His voice and that of CBS's Walter Cronkite are the ones most fixed in my memory, along with the garbled, or was it flubbed, line from Mr. Armstrong. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. What'd he say, Mr. Cronkite asked an on-air colleague. It took a while, as I recall, for anyone to mention, or perhaps to notice, the charming redundancy. Humans had done the impossible, but once the lunar frontier had been opened, America soon turned its back on it. Sending humans into space was massively expensive. Domestic needs and the war in Vietnam called for attention, and the propaganda value of lunar landings had faded. It would take years to rebuild the momentum for manned space flight. Meanwhile, NASA began doing more with much less. Voyagers 1 and 2 and the New Horizons probes visited the outer planets and Pluto. Rovers and orbiters are still active on and around Mars. NASA discovered ice volcanoes, landscapes once shaped by running water, ice-coated moons, enclosing vast seas, even a poignant giant heart shape on Pluto. Here on Earth, finding life thriving under extreme conditions has raised hopes of finding life, quote, out there too. Late last month, NASA announced plans to send a car-sized quadcopter to one of Saturn's moons. Titan, a top target in the search for extraterrestrial life. And if the space agency broadcasts the landing of that probe or live streams the onboard results of tests for life, this grown-up outer space nerd will be watching, a witness to history. Maybe I'll jot down what I'm wearing. Weekly editor Owen Thomas can be reached at his email address, thomaso thomaso at csmonitor.com. And now for the feature story by Eva Botkin-Kowacki, One Giant Feat for Mankind. Boston. Neil Armstrong almost didn't land on the moon because he was running out of gas. It was July 20th, 1969. Mr. Armstrong and fellow astronaut Edwin Buzz Aldrin were descending toward the moon, about to change the course of human history, when things started to go wrong. First came an alarm indicating something awry with the spacecraft. Then another. After a few 10 seconds, engineers at Mission Control in Houston decided it wasn't catastrophic. It was the landing computer on the spacecraft signaling an overload. Charles Duke Jr., the official communicator with the space capsule, or CAPCOM, all in capital letters, CAPCOM, relayed a message to the astronauts. Proceed. Then came the fuel problem. As the lunar module drew closer to the landing site, the Sea of Tranquility, Mr. Armstrong could see that he would have to make an adjustment. Where existing maps had shown a smooth region, car-sized boulders cluttered a field of craters. Mr. Armstrong had to search for a safe landing spot manually. The catch? It would take precious fuel. Tensions were high in Houston. Nobody spoke. You could have heard a pin drop in the room of about 100 people, recalls Flight Director Jerry Griffin. In an interview, mission controllers listened intently as Mr. Aldrin called out the speed and range of the spacecraft. 60 seconds came the warning from Houston, indicating how much time the astronauts had until a mandatory abort for low fuel. The spacecraft was still about 100 feet above the surface. 30 seconds came a second warning. Those seconds seemed to be going by awfully fast, says Mr. Griffin. Finally, Mr. Aldrin's voice crackled across the radio. Contact light. One of the module's footpads had touched the surface. A few people in mission control pumped their fist. Chief Flight Director Gene Kranz cautioned everyone to calm down. There was still work to do, and they didn't have official confirmation from the astronauts. Then it came. Houston, the Eagle has landed. Roger, Tranquility, Mr. Duke stuttered. Back in a southern drawl, we copy you on ground. You've got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. That night in Houston, Mr. Griffin took a moment to look up at the illuminated half moon in the ink-black sky. We did it, he recalls saying to a colleague. There's guys sitting up there on that thing that we put there. 50 years ago, the United States did the, quote, impossible. It landed a man on the moon. It took hundreds of thousands of people and billions of dollars, but NASA achieved one of the great milestones in human history. The dramatic moment temporarily united a nation, cleaved by the Vietnam War, boosted the U.S. in its geopolitical clash with the Soviet Union, and opened up the imaginative possibilities of human spaceflight for an entire world. Indeed, some 600 million people around the globe watched the grainy footage of Mr. Armstrong's giant leap for mankind. It even gave the world a new cultural metaphor. Prior to the feat, the phrase, "it's like landing on the moon," referred to something that couldn't be done. Afterward, it meant that, with enough effort, humanity could achieve anything. Today, as celebrations across the U.S. mark the anniversary of the momentous Apollo 11 mission, people worldwide are once again pondering their next journeys into the cosmos. Several space agencies are planning trips to the moon. Others are looking out farther, to Mars. What will be the world's next moonshots? Since the dawn of humanity, the moon has occupied a central place in our consciousness. Unlike other planetary bodies, the moon appears as more than just a pinprick of light in the sky, inviting us to imagine it as another world. It has been the source of infinite mythologies. In one Buddhist tale, a hare, that's H-A-R-E, that sacrifices itself to feed a hungry priest is honored by its likeness being etched in the moon's surface for all to see. Khonsu, spelled K-H-O-N-S-U, the ancient Egyptian moon god, was thought to watch over those who travel at night. In ancient China, the moon represented rejuvenation. The moon was long seen as a perfect orb, its dark markings explained through legends and other stories. But Galileo's closer examination of the moon revealed its imperfections, and humanity's view took on new dimension, an object worthy of scientific study. You've got this second narrative running, speculation about the condition, what conditions are like, what the temperature is like, whether anything lives there, says Alice Gorman, an expert in space archaeology at Flinders University in Adelaide, Australia. As ground-based study of the moon advanced, it opened up more questions and mysteries. Despite humanity's long-held fascination with the moon and the scientific potential of sending a person there, NASA targeted the planetary body for another reason: power. The U.S. and the Soviet Union were engaged in a global struggle for dominance. Everything was a competition, and space emerged as one of the most visible and prestigious battlegrounds in this existential fight. This was war by another means, says Roger Lanius, former chief historian for NASA and author of Apollo's Legacy. The U.S. was already lagging in the space race since the Soviet launch of Sputnik in 1957, but the nation that landed on the moon would gain an important edge in its quest to lead the world into the future. That's what lay behind President John F. Kennedy's speech summoning a nation to the task. "We choose to go to the moon," he famously said in an address at Rice University in Houston in 1962. "We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard." And hard it was. Washington pumped more than 4% of the federal budget into NASA in the early years of the Apollo program. Today, by comparison, the space agency accounts for about 0.5% of the federal budget. The project cost $25 billion and employed 400,000 people, many of whom rarely saw their families because they worked so many hours. Three astronauts died when a fire broke out in their spacecraft during a pre-launch test for what was supposed to be the first crewed mission of the Apollo program. Still, before the decade was over, Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Aldrin had planted an American flag on the moon. It was a persuasive event that established in people's minds around the world that the Soviets were not the wave of the future, says James Oberg, space analyst and former NASA space shuttle engineer. It was a grand slam home run. The U.S. didn't lay claim to the moon. The flag was just symbolic, and much of the language around the lunar landing celebrated it as a collective human achievement. Publicly, the Soviets lauded the giant leap for mankind, too. But privately, says Mr. Oberg, an expert on the Russian space program, they were devastated. Although geopolitical posturing drove NASA's Apollo program, its legacy extends beyond pride and political gain. The six missions that landed on the moon brought back 842 pounds of rocks, core samples, and dust, and set up science experiments that are still paying dividends. The potent symbolism and imagery that emerged from the Apollo missions also profoundly affected global perspectives of both the Earth and ourselves. From tens of thousands of miles away, the Earth looks like the globe on a teacher's desk, but the political boundaries are wiped away, and the blackness around it provides a stark contrast to the bright, lively planet hanging in the void of space. The Earth appears as a whole system, interconnected and complete. Although we know intellectually that we live on a planet, astronauts have said viewing it from space gives them a unique understanding of how our world is a small, precious oasis in an expansive cosmos. Going to the moon gave us a whole new perspective on what our planet is and what our life means, says space historian Amy Sherrah Tytel. Apollo astronauts snapped photos of the Earth from afar that are credited with helping propel the environmental movement in the 1970s. Scientifically, the Apollo moon landings also taught us a lot about the makeup of the planet. If you want to understand what happened early in Earth's history and what may have triggered the rise of life here, you have to go to the moon, says David Kring, senior scientist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. The Earth and moon are intimately connected, dancing through space in tandem. So any rocks or radiation that pass through the neighborhood usually affect both. On the Earth's surface, craters caused by space debris and other indications of what was going on early in the planet's history have largely been erased by plate tectonics, volcanism, and erosion. On the moon, there's been little deletion of the geologic record. As a result, the scientific data and hundreds of pounds of moon rocks gathered during the Apollo missions lifted the veil of mystery, not just on the moon, but also on the Earth. Before the Apollo program, the origin of the moon was an enigma. Some scientists thought it was a simple asteroid drawn into orbit by Earth's gravitational pull. Others surmised it was a world of its own. But Apollo discoveries brought geologists into a scientific consensus that the body probably formed when a Mars-sized planet smashed into Earth, sending rocks and dust from both worlds into orbit. There, the debris coalesced into the moon. What the Apollo program did was convert the moon from an object of fascination to a place we could explore, says NASA planetary scientist Samuel Lawrence. Many of the 12 astronauts who landed on the moon hopped along the surface, using the low-gravity environment to help them move around in their cumbersome spacesuits. Not Harrison Jack Schmidt. He preferred to pretend he was cross-country skiing. He skimmed along the dusty landscape, which may have helped him make a serendipitous discovery. Dr. Schmidt was the first scientist astronaut and the 12th and last man to step onto the moon in December 1972. On one lunar walk, the geologist perused the rim of a crater called Shorty, looking for clues to validate a little supported theory that it was formed by a volcanic eruption rather than from the impact of space rock. While Dr. Smith was shuffling along, his boots scuffed below the gray lunar surface to reveal a strangely colored material. "Oh, hey," the astronaut exclaimed. "There's orange soil." To anyone else, the orange sediments might have seemed just a curiosity, but Dr. Schmidt knew instantly he had found something important. "My immediate thought was maybe this is volcanic," he recalls during a recent interview, but he couldn't be sure until he looked at the grains through a microscope, so he quickly dug a trench to collect a pristine sample of the colorful particles. Back on Earth, the orange soil did turn out to be volcanic, tiny beads of glass formed from volcanic ash. But the grains formed well before Shorty, meaning it was an impact crater. Still, over the past 5 decades, geologists have continued to study the orange particles along with green glass collected by the Apollo 15 crew. Both could prove vital to future space travel. "Using basic chemistry," explains Dr. Lawrence, "it's possible to extract resources like water, oxygen, and other chemical ingredients to make propellants. Ice spotted in craters at the moon's poles could also be used." Together, these revelations have sparked interest in using the moon as a base where spacecraft can refuel en route to more distant places in space. While the moon has yielded invaluable scientific secrets, it has also provided some colorful vignettes from the people who have walked on its surface. "It's one of the world's most exclusive fraternities. Only 4 of the dozen men who have walked on the Earth are still alive. One of them is Mr. Duke, the ground communicator with Apollo 11. After years of dreaming, years of training, and many tense hours talking, Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Aldrin threw that inaugural landing. The first thing Mr. Duke did when he got to the moon himself was take a nap. It was April 20th, 1972. The lunar module, Orion, had just settled on the dusty surface. Apollo 16 mission commander John Young and Mr. Duke, the lunar module pilot, would soon descend the wobbly ladder to become the 9th and 10th humans to walk on the moon. But first they removed their space suits, ate supper, and clambered into their sleeping hammocks. Mr. Young dozed off immediately. Mr. Duke found it difficult to quiet his mind. "I was just exploding with joy," he says. Sleeping wasn't by choice. Hours earlier, while the crew waited in lunar orbit, Mission Control had deliberated whether to even attempt the landing. There was a technical problem that Houston thought might jeopardize the ability of the crew to return to Earth. "If your heart can drop to the bottom of your boots in zero gravity," it did, Mr. Duke says. "We had trained 2 years. We'd come 250,000 miles, basically, and our landing spot was 8 miles beneath us, and they were about to tell us to come home." Fortunately, 6 hours later, Mission Control figured out a solution and gave Apollo 16 a go for the 5th landing on the moon. But the delay had shifted the astronauts' schedule. Houston told them they needed to sleep. "Walking on the moon may be a once-in-a-lifetime experience, but the Apollo astronauts couldn't just stop and take in the scenery. You don't want to waste any time," Dr. Schmidt says. "Time on the moon is precious, and losing any could prove fatal." Moonwalks and excursions in the lunar rover vehicle were carefully timed so the astronauts wouldn't run out of air to breathe in their spacesuits. Buffer time was included in case something went wrong. But Dr. Schmidt and Mission Commander Eugene Cernan had numerous samples to collect and untouched lunar terrain to explore. They had some 22 hours over three moonwalks to do it. Other Apollo missions had even less time. But that doesn't mean Dr. Schmidt didn't notice the environment around him while he worked. He vividly recalls the details of the Apollo 17 landing site. Imagine being in a valley deeper than the Grand Canyon, he says, with a brilliant sun, a blacker-than-black sky, and the earth hanging over the southwest wall of the valley, always in the same place. It doesn't move. That's because the moon always keeps the same face towards the earth. With no air on the moon, it's often described as silent. But Dr. Schmidt says, with a chuckle, it better not be, or you're going to be in trouble. Pumps and fans whirred in the astronauts' suits to maintain safe body temperatures and circulate oxygen. Temperatures on the moon can range from 260 degrees Fahrenheit to negative 280 degrees. Apollo astronauts also constantly spoke to each other and checked in with mission control over the radio. Bounding around in cumbersome spacesuits in unfamiliar low gravity of the moon is tricky. Apollo astronauts took a lot of tumbles. It's like being a kid this high again, Dr. Schmidt says, holding his hand 2 feet above the floor. But it's very easy to get up because 1/6 gravity doesn't hold you down. Despite being in a place so inhospitable to humans, Dr. Schmidt says he was relaxed. He could often, in fact, be heard singing throughout his mission. At one point, Dr. Schmidt altered the lyrics to "The Fountain in the Park" by Ed Haley to fit the scene. Instead of crooning, "I was strolling through the park one day," he improvised with "I was strolling on the moon one day." Mr. Cernan joined in. The duo bounced along the moon, singing as they went about their work. Whether anyone will ever sing or stroll on the moon again is an open question, especially given that it's been 47 years since the last landing. Three more Apollo missions were originally planned, but the program ended with number 17 in December 1972. Humans have not gone back to the moon or even left Earth's orbit since. That's not to say interplanetary aspirations have evaporated. Space agencies and private companies have outlined several grandiose proposals over the past several decades to return to the moon or even go to Mars. None has taken off so far. NASA's latest plan is a program called Artemis, named for the Greek goddess of hunting and Apollo's twin sister. Announced earlier this year, it envisions landing humans on the moon by 2024, with the ultimate goal of establishing a base to test space technologies and act as a way station to Mars. Funding remains a formidable obstacle. Where's the money going to come from, and how much money is it going to take, says space historian Mr. Lanius. That's really the question you have to ask over and over. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine has estimated that Artemis could cost $20 billion to $30 billion over the next 5 years on top of the normal NASA budget. The Apollo program represented a singular moment, Mr. Lanius says. NASA received the federal funding it needed because of the geopolitical context of the era, which doesn't exist today. Still, the Apollo moon missions and the hype surrounding the space race helped spawn a generation of dreamers who want to make deep space travel a reality, with or without government help. Take Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon and the private space flight company Blue Origin. We all got to witness the moon landing as a civilization, and it really made people realize the kind of things we could do, he told an audience at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum in Boston in June. Mr. Bezos was 5 years old when Mr. Armstrong stepped onto the moon. Now he's leading a company with ambitions to return there. I definitely got that bug, he said, and I kept after it. Private aerospace companies such as Blue Origin, SpaceX, and Boeing are vying to build the next generation of rockets and spacecrafts. Boeing and SpaceX are running final tests on systems that could send Americans to the International Space Station by the end of this year. Entrepreneurs and NASA aren't the only ones with lofty goals. Russian President Vladimir Putin said in 2018 that his country will begin manned missions to the moon and Mars in the upcoming years. China is also establishing a human presence in space. The quest to someday walk on another planetary body is understandable to those who have already done it. Dr. Schmidt still remembers his last stroll on the lunar surface. As a true geologist, he was picking up rocks one final time. He took a look around the valley, letting his eyes linger on the horizon to commit the alien scene to memory. What sticks out in his mind today is the stark contrast between the barren lunar landscape under a pitch-black sky and the colorful little module the astronauts had called home for 3 days. It's more than anybody can describe, he says, of the lunar surface. It's a spectacular place to be. That concludes this article and our time together. I'm Philip Moore for Radio Reading Services. Thanks for joining me. Join me again next week when we take a look at another edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, here on the radio that reads to the Tri-State, WRRS.